Hi, this is James Barris. I hope you find this talk supports you in your practice. If you'd like to support my teaching, you can use the donate button underneath my picture on Dharma Seed to do that. Your support is greatly appreciated.
Good evening. Good to be here with you. Just taking you all in and whatever your day was like, just imagining, well, not imagining, just sensing the sincerity that you brought to your practice today. You're still here, so that's saying something. Whatever level of sincerity you brought, I imagine it was as much as you could bring today. And I bow to you for it and appreciate you. Somebody asked today a question about bowing. And it was perfect because it's actually what I want to talk about tonight. Not a whole talk on bowing, but the theme or the source, the energy that bowing might come from when you're connected with it. I want to talk about devotion tonight. And that might be a word that lands on some of you, yay, and on others, oh no. I just don't get it. You know, I had a hard time with bowing when I first was into this. You know, what are they doing there? But I want to talk about that heartfelt quality that gives juice to practice, whatever word you use, and we can explore different words that might resonate for you. When you're getting bored with practice, or it becomes dry, mechanical, has that happened to anyone here? It happens to most practitioners at some point. There's a need for that juice that can keep us not only going on, but rekindling that excitement of the adventure of what we are doing here. So just watch where the mind goes when you hear the word devotion. If there's judgment, if there's resistance, if there's frustration, just allow for it all. I know that, you know, so many of us have in our past, in our upbringing, different ways of relating to whatever spiritual teachings or tradition that we came into this world, and it's not an easy one for many people. Especially, you've come to the Buddhist path, the Theravadan Buddhist path, which is sometimes called the path with no railings. The path with no railings. There's nothing to hold on to or to give your love to in the sense of some creator being. But it's very important, I think, for us to connect with it, especially being in this lineage, or at least practicing this lineage and this approach to the teachings. As some of you might know, I came from a devotional bhakti lineage before I got into Buddha Dharma. I was raised Jewish, but then at some point I got into, in my experience of devotion started when I was, and some of you have heard this story, so just let it flow like beginner's mind, but for some, maybe not. Anyway, it's relevant to what I'm talking about. I read Be Here Now. I might have mentioned that I read Be Here Now, 1971 when it came out. And it changed my life. And there was something about reading that book that Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba, just leaped out of the pages and right into my heart. And I could not explain or understand it at all. All I knew was something was awakening in me. And I felt a kind of love and purity of heart that was new to me. And I carried around Be Here Now like a Bible for the next, well, for the next 20 years, the next 50 years, but I carried it around like a Bible for about 3 years. And then I met Ram Dass. And when I met him, he turned me on. I asked him about meditation. I'd been doing TM, Transcendental Meditation, and he recommended meditation. I said, what do you think? What should I do? And he said, this is at Naropa, the first summer at Naropa in 1974. And he said, there's this fellow Goldstein who's teaching a course in essential Buddhism. He's pretty good. Why don't you go there? And I did. And after 10 minutes, I found what I was looking for. First 10 minutes, there was a lot of judgment. Well, he doesn't look very spiritual to me. But then I just was hearing what he was saying and feeling what he was saying, and just remembering now this feeling, oh, I found what I'm looking for. But it can get very dry when you go back home to New York City, where I was living, and no sangha at all that I knew of. And then at some point, Joseph, who I had been in touch with, I said, you know, I'm sitting every day, just getting, it's a bit dry. I feel alone. And he told me that Ram Dass was offering this invitation-only class. And he said, why don't you check it out and see if it works for you? So I contacted Ram Dass, and we had an interview to see if it would work. And at that conversation, and he knew that I was coming from a very, I was completely committed to Buddha Dharma at that point, sitting very, very committedly. And among other things, he said, well, you know, this is a bhakti, a devotional path. How do you feel about that? I said, well, you know, Neem Karoli Baba certainly has touched my heart. He said, we're going to be doing chanting and mala beads and, you know, Sri Ram, Jai Ram and stuff like that. How does that feel? I said, well, I don't know. I want to give it a shot. And then he said, well, let me ask you, I want to ask you a few questions. He said, how do you feel about Jesus? And he said, "Do you love Jesus?" I said, "I like Jesus." I don't know if I love him the way I sense, you know, but his teachings are beautiful. You know, but I don't know if I love Jesus. And then he said, "Well, what about Krishna? This is a, you know, Hindu bhakti scene. Do you love Krishna?" I like Krishna. Just that sense of celebration with life and dancing with life, which I definitely had in me, but I don't know if I love Krishna. And then he said, "Well, how about God? Do you love God?" And I said, "You know, Ramdas, I was raised Jewish, as he was, and I don't know how the images got in. Maybe it was some picture Bible book that I had growing up, but my image of God is this very powerful man, definitely a man with a beard and a big book and a magic pen saying, 'You're going to have a good day and you're not.'" And so rather than loving God, it actually put the fear of God in me. But when I hear the word God, I translate it in these more recent years as the Dharma. And that fits for me. And then he said, "Well, do you love the Dharma?" With that, no hesitation, I said, "Oh, yeah." And then he said, "You sure?" I said, "Oh, absolutely. It's the most important thing in my life." And then he said, "Have you ever told the Dharma that you loved it?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, go ahead. What do you mean?" He said, "Just you say, 'I love you, Dharma.'" I said, "Really?" He said, "I'll say it with you. Go ahead, you just say it." I felt like a jerk saying, "I love you, Dharma." And then he said, "I love you, Dharma." And he said, "Keep on going." I said, "I love you, Dharma." He answered back. And by the third or fourth time, I felt it. And I started crying, tears coming down my cheeks. At which point he said, "Oh, there's hope for you yet. Okay, you can come in this class." So I come from that lineage, and then when I got into I spent the next year in that course, and I kept on asking, I don't know if my lineage is Buddhist or Bhakti, and going back and forth because the Buddhist side seemed dry at times, and the bhakti side, but it seemed so clean. And the bhakti side seemed a bit sloppy to me, my Buddhist temperament, you know, just seeing things as they are. And I don't know, but it also was so juicy. So I went back and forth, and I would ask him a number of times, "Bhakti, Buddhist, bhakti, Buddhist." And he said, I finally got it. He said, "Don't worry about picking your path. Your path will pick you." And then at one point, about 10 months in or so, it occurred to me, Neem Karoli Baba's main instructions are love everyone, serve everyone, remember God. And the main practices that the Buddha teaches, non-hatred, non-greed, non-delusion. Love everyone, non-hatred. Serve everyone, non-greed. Remember God, non-delusion. And at that point, it all came together. Oh, it's just They're both saying the same thing, just in different language and different energies and styles. So getting back to this word devotion, you know, when I said, I love you, Dharma, it was a moment I remember very well, like yesterday. And one reason I share that is that I would guess that everyone here can say in one way or another, I love the Dharma. You might use different words, but there's this deep heartfelt quality that got you here to sign up for 1 or 2 months. I mean, it's a pretty strange thing to do. So why did you do it? Because there's something in there that you couldn't ignore. So as I said, the word devotion can evoke different feelings for different people, and depending upon your conditioning. And just reflect, what is your relationship to the word devotion? How does it land for you? Now, however it does is fine. And maybe if there's some resistance, is there another word that you resonate better with that conveys that same spirit? And if so, what word really works for you? Okay, you can open your eyes. Maybe if you'd be willing again to, you know, just call out really loud if there's a word that resonates besides devotion that fits you better. Just raise your hand. Yes. Yes, speak up. Say again. You got to speak a bit.
She likes devotion, but she's offering commitment.
Ah, you like devotion, but you're offering commitment. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Commitment. Okay, lovely. Yes.
Sincerity.
It's a beautiful word. Love. Anyone more? Yes. Truth. Beautiful. I'm not looking for the right word. Just, it's important for you to find the word that touches you. And I'll share some others as we go on. So I wanted to look tonight both from a Theravadin viewpoint and also bring in some other traditions as the analogy says, the spiritual path, there are many fingers pointing to the moon. And to honor all traditions that have been passed on because they've taken people to the deepest place of freedom. This is from Yanapanika Thera. I think somebody quoted him before here, and he was Bhikkhu Bodhi's mentor, ran the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka for many years, and he wrote a number of wonderful treatises that really moved me, Heart of Buddhist Meditation, The Power of Mindfulness. And he's German and a very analytical mind. And sometimes it seems like a real scholar. But this is what he has to say about devotion. It would be a mistake to conclude that the Buddha disparaged a reverential and devotional attitude of mind when it is the natural outflow of true understanding and a deep admiration of what is great and noble. It would be a grievous error to believe that the seeing of the Dhamma, that's awakening, is identical with a mere intellectual appreciation and purely conceptual grasp of the doctrine. such a one-sided abstract approach to the very concrete message of the Buddha all too often leads to intellectual smugness. In its barrenness, it will certainly not be a substitute for the strong and enlivening impulse imparted by a deep felt devotion to what is known as great, noble, and exemplary. Required for final deliverance, it is needed to resolve any stagnation and other shortcomings resulting from a one-sided development of the intellectual faculties. Such development often tends to turn around in circles endlessly without being able to effect a breakthrough. Here, devotion and confidence and faith, all aspects of the Pali term sadha, may be able to give quick and effective help. And in Theravadin monasteries, devotion is everywhere. Jack Kornfield, who was a monk for 4 years with Ajahn Chah in Thailand, he said he learned soon after taking on robes, if it moves, you bow. Just whatever, you're bowing all the time. And as you're bowing, just a word about bowing, you're really honoring and respecting all beings as worthy of your respect and reverence. You know, we had metta for all beings. You're bowing in the same way that in Hinduism, if you go to India, people all the time are saying, namaste, namaste. Namaste is really saying the divine in me meets the divine in you, where we are one. And that if you can get into that kind of a spirit, it really brings something out of you where you feel a live connection. But it's not so easy at times for, you know, some people just don't feel that. Don't worry about it. All you can do is just be right where you're at. And as I go into this, please, if there's the comparing mind or the judging mind, I just don't have it, I don't know what he's talking about, hold that all with lots of love and lots of compassion. You can only be where you are. But this quality of reverence and respect, the Buddha talked about it a lot. And in the teachings, he spoke of there are wisdom followers or Dhamma followers, they're called, where one understands the teachings. And then there are also faith followers who are devoted to the teachings and to the Buddha, not in a groupy way. And in fact, there's one story where one monk was so enamored of the Buddha, he'd sit up in front and all the time and just gaze at him. And at some point, the Buddha kicked him out of the sangha. He said, no, it's not getting the idea. And as the story goes, Vakali was his name, he was so bereft at getting rejected by his love object that he was about to throw himself off over a cliff when the Buddha, as these stories go, magically appeared with his supramundane powers. And he said, don't, Vakali. He said, you can look at this form for 100 years and not see the Buddha. One who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Vakali came back and, as all good stories, became fully enlightened at some point. So it's not about blind faith and that kind of devotion. But the Buddha did say, take refuge in me. Take refuge in what I'm sharing. Take refuge in the Dharma. And there are these faith followers who become enlightened just out of that purity of heart, different from the wisdom followers, but just as full liberation. Like I said, in this Theravadan lineage, the path with no railings, there's not that kind of surrender as there are in other lineages. We have Kalyanamita, a spiritual friend, and Tibetans have Guru Yoga, where you see your teacher as the Buddha or as the Guru, and there's a quality of surrender there. Kim and I were talking on the way up here, and she, I hope it's okay to share that she, even though she's a full-on Theravadan Buddhist, she's got tankas that remind her of that quality. Because we can borrow that quality, and even if we're not feeling it directly ourselves, but this Theravadan lineage, it's not spoken all that much, especially in the West. But there is this quality that comes from a deep surrender, a surrender of me. Have you noticed you don't control the show? Surrendering me controlling the show or figuring out to something much bigger than myself. That quality of sadha, one of the five spiritual faculties, which is translated, I think, Jaya gave a talk on faith. Faith, trust, confidence, conviction, and this quality of this juice, putting your heart upon something. This is what I think it'd be beneficial for us all to explore. How can we access it? In one of the lists, this quality is beautifully expressed, as I understand this list. There's different interpretations of this list. This is a list of the four Iddhipadas, and it's part of the 37 factors of enlightenment. You wanted lists, you got lists. There, and it's comprised of a number of different lists. There's the Eightfold Path, seven factors of enlightenment, five faculties, which become the five powers, four foundations of mindfulness, four wise efforts, which we spoke about, and then there's this last one. You probably have heard of all those others, and then there's this one, the four Iddhipadas, which are called the bases of success. Iddhi, I-D-D-H-I. In Sanskrit, the word siddhi, you might know that word, is powers. Somebody has siddhis, they have powers. And these are four powers, different temperaments that people come to practice with. And I'll just briefly mention three of them, but particularly the fourth. One is called Chanda Iddhipada, where somebody just has a natural enthusiasm and zeal. Yeah, this is so amazing, so cool, fabulous. Then there's Virya Iddhipada, which I spoke about, I think, or pointed to earlier, that heroic effort. Let my bones dry up, my sinews fall away. I will exert myself as much as possible. And when you have that kind of heroic effort, you are there for everything. And that's Virya Iddhipada. There's Vimamsa Iddhipada, which is about seeing, investigating the situation that you're in, and you see how precious this human birth is, how extraordinary it is to have a human birth, or how cause and effect, how karma at least works, that as you practice, you are heading in a certain direction. And there is the impermanence and death, how any moment could be the end. And there's the defects of samsara. So one investigates and sees, whoa, I want to make use of this time. Like the Buddha saying, oh, we're like children playing with our toys, not realizing that the house is on fire. And when you really see it, you practice with that kind of diligence. So those are three of the Iddhipadas. The fourth, it's actually third in that, in this list traditionally, is called Citta Iddhipada. And Citta, same word that is translated as heart and mind. In this context, the way I understand it, when you've been touched by the Dharma, when you've really been touched deeply, and you can't ignore it, and it becomes the central thing in your life, and not, can I fit my practice into my life? My life is held in a spirit of practice. Like a moth to a flame. And I'm not saying that you don't feel if that's not you, that's okay. Just be right where you are. But at times, you are so moved that you feel this in your heart, this yearning, this spiritual passion. One of my teachers, Punjaji, who is an Advaita teacher, Dharma heir of Ramana Maharshi, he says, the desire for freedom is our most intense desire. Once we feel it, all other desires are seen as on the surface. They rise and fall. But the desire for freedom is intense, and you must respond to it. When you respond, this desire will bring you back home. It will continue to trouble you if it is not fulfilled. This desire must be fulfilled whether you like it or not. I was saying to a yogi here, we were talking about this. There's a beautiful collection of poems in a book, and I think one of the poems has this title, by Rumi, called This Longing. Have you gotten in touch with this longing to go beyond that samvega, the meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived, and long for freedom? If you're not caught too much in attachment, it can be just a beautiful source, this citta iddhipada of practice. So, with this quality of refuge in the Dharma, what is it? What are we surrendering to? Because that's the key in devotion. We're surrendering to something bigger than ourselves. And in other traditions, it's easier. That's why this is the path with no railings. But when there's God or Jesus or something or some that we're devoted to, it's easy to give your heart, or to a guru. In Judaism, in Orthodox Judaism, my understanding, the word God which is spelled G-D. You don't even say the word, spell it out. Or when you're, say, unless you're saying your prayers in Hebrew, you substitute a kind of placeholder for that word. But the word God is a placeholder for that which cannot be named, that which is beyond our human mind and comprehension. And in Hinduism, we are surrendering to something outside of ourselves, but at some point we see through that separation. And I love in the Ramayana, the great epic story of Ram and the wars about liberation. And Ram, the servant of Ram is Hanuman, the monkey god, who Neem Karoli Baba was said to be an incarnation of Hanuman, the servant of God. And at one point, Hanuman says to Ram, "When I forget who I am, I serve you. When I remember who I am, you and I are one." I love that line. When I forget who I am, I serve you. When I remember who I am, you and I are one. And the saying in Hinduism, when you truly awaken, you see God, Guru, and Self are one. So, how to access this? Sometimes, as Kim and I were talking about, you borrow from someone else or something else. When I was in my probably teens, I loved music, and there was this one blind gospel singer, blind Reverend Gary Davis, who I still play. He was the only thing, he and Doc Watson were the only thing that I played for like a year. Listening to him was not the only thing, the main thing that I played as he sang, "You Gotta Move." And then this amazing guitar, "You Gotta Move." And I'd play over and over. I liked Jesus. I didn't. But I borrowed his feeling. I just wanted to feel what he felt. It really brought me alive. I remember in one retreat here, I was sitting for a month in March, and I'd get into the hall. I had a very different schedule, and I'd come into the hall when nobody was here in the middle of the night. And one night, somebody comes in. This is like, 3 in the morning, and I was aware, who's coming in now? And I heard footsteps coming up to the front, and I see this young female yogi who I've since gotten to know, and she comes up to the altar. I was peeking at this point. What's going on? And she lights a candle, and she bows just reverentially for some time. And I was so moved just seeing her devotion, and it just took me to a deeper level in my practice. So we can borrow that from others. I was just speaking before I came down here with Andrea, who we were talking about devotion, and we were talking about when we were moved and how devotion was expressed, and she shared a story. I won't share the story because it's involved, but she said, in that moment, I saw my mind in a way I'd never seen it before, and I just fell down to my knees. Literally, I fell down to my knees. And as she was telling the story, I was kind of getting excited. Oh, now I'll really be up for giving this talk, you know, because I got a transmission from it. Do you remember when you fell to your knees, whether literally or figuratively, when you fell in love with the Dharma? Or maybe in the last few days since you've been here, there have been moments where you saw something in another way, not just purely analytical, but that awakens something deep inside of you that maybe you couldn't even explain. Amazing grace. That's what I think of it as. Amazing grace. How does that happen? Yeah, you're practicing, breathing in, breathing out, lifting, moving, placing. Yeah, with this moment. And then all of a sudden, boom, you see something. And it's not just an intellectual understanding. You feel it in your being. If you've had a glimpse of that, I'm just curious. Just a show of hands. Yeah, see, it happens. That's something really precious. Don't forget that moment. In the Tibetan teachings, those moments are called triggers for insight. Just like we can be activated and triggered with trauma, we can be activated and triggered with something very beautiful inside. And when somebody comes in and said, I had this experience yesterday, it was just so profound, you know, but I know I'm not supposed to get attached, and I'll just let go. And I'll say, no. Let's go back there. Let's remember it. Because it's there, and it can access that place that's beyond the thinking mind. I can remember being in the Insight Meditation Society dining room in 1979, stirring a cup of kaffix. Does not sound like a very profound thing. I stirred that cup of kaffix and I looked at the bubbles in there swirling around and keeping on swirling, and I saw Anicca in a way that I never did before, from the smallest atoms to the largest galaxies and the whole universe, all just in constant motion. And I just think of that moment as I'm doing now, speaking to you. I'm right back there. I'm right back there, and I know the truth of Anicca in my bones. That's the kind of thing that's really precious, that amazing grace that takes you out of your being. And I want to share with you a couple of other teachings from outside of the Theravadin that have helped me pointing to the moon of something deep inside. And since they've affected me, I thought I'd share it with you. One is, I think I mentioned here, Anam Tupten, this, you know, wonderful Tibetan teacher who, and we teach together, we'll be teaching Magic of Awareness retreat later on this year. And this is from his book, Magic of Awareness. It's a great book. And this is a paragraph that has really stayed with me. See how this feels or lands for you. You are consciousness, and so am I. Consciousness is said to be groundless because it has no size, color, shape, or location. Some people think that consciousness is living in us. However, such a view is very limited in scope, since this consciousness is all-pervading. We live in it. We are it. It enjoys eternal play. Now and then, consciousness forgets that its play is its own manifestation. I'd say maybe a little bit more than now and then. Now and then, consciousness forgets that its play is its own manifestation and gets lost in believing that it is separate from itself. That forgetfulness is the fundamental delusion that gives birth to all troubles, problems, and struggles in unending chain reactions. Since consciousness itself is not separate from awakening, consciousness being aware of itself can happen suddenly and break the chain created by our forgetfulness. So in that way, it's remembering itself through you, remembering you, remembering who you really are. And I'll share with you another teaching that has been very just meaningful to me in this last year that I love, from Kashmir Shaivism, which is very, has similar roots to Tibetan Tantra, Tantric Buddhism. The realization of our true heart. And I'll just share, it's 20 lines. I'll just share a few of the lines. Very similar to Anam Tupten's. And just take it for whatever it's, however it lands. This is, again, this is not Theravadin, just another way of seeing things. It starts out, this which is mysterious, uncaused, and unnameable, yet called by many names, mystery, pure awareness, pure consciousness, he, as in the guy with the beard, she, it, this, God, called by many names, this has given birth to the entire universe. By the power of its own free will, the mystery unfolds the entire cosmos out of itself, while always remaining one with its creations. Its infinite array of expressions appear as seemingly separate names and forms in constant interaction one with the other. But even as its infinite expressions appear separate, they remain forever undivided. Through the power of the mystery's own free will, again, just let go, it contracts and limits itself as body-minds. who perceives separation and separate objects everywhere. As a body-mind, that's you and me, the mystery conceals its true nature, identifies with the mind's movements, feels itself limited by time, space, desire, knowledge, and form, and takes on the belief that it and everything are separate. Through the power of self-limitation, it takes on the role of being a limited entity who is born, dies, believes in separation, suffers, and searches to end suffering. Concealing its true identity and taking on the belief of separation, it engages in five functions of manifestation, which is birth, maintenance, preservation, reabsorption, death, concealment, and divine grace or remembering. So in the game, the way this teaching goes, this mystery contracts and becomes separate, and part of the game, besides birth, preservation, and reabsorption or death, is forgetting. That's in the game. And it's also in the game to remember. And this is where it gets read a little bit more towards the later on. In its role as a separate entity, it turns the mind inward, enabling it to remember the true state of affairs. That the entire play of birth, life, death, concealment, and revelation are simply itself disguised, delighting in its own display of apparently separate forms and names. Concealed within the illusory veil of separation, with the mind turned inward, its fire of awareness partially burns away all misperceptions of separation and suffering. Sound familiar? As the belief in separation dissolves, in a timeless moment of revelation, the entire universe, everything, is realized to be simply its own self. In this moment, it absorbs everything back into itself. And now I'll just read one last one. The means for recognizing and abiding in and as this, our true heart and true home, include, but are not limited to, the following five methods. Here's the first method. Not identifying with thoughts as they arise. That's it. That's the game. The other are very, very much more subtle states, abiding as a thought-free state of mind, remaining inwardly focused, even as attention turns outward to worldly objects and movements, and then it gets more and more refined. But the way to see through the whole game is to simply not identify with thoughts as they arise. Wow. Encouraging, isn't it? It's available to you every moment that you see through the mental fabrication. some other, in these last few moments, some other ways that you can bring this quality of seeing through that separation where you remember that you and it are one, to paraphrase Hanuman. Just loving the moment. Sometimes it's not that you like every moment, but to put your heart into it and see the preciousness of awareness, knowing this moment. And in that deep presence, everything comes alive. Everything becomes sacred. Einstein says, there are two ways to go through life. One is seeing nothing as a miracle, and the other is seeing everything as a miracle. Just play around with seeing everything as a miracle. I mean, how is it possible that I can say the word blue and you see blue perhaps in your mind? Or I can say, a luscious, delicious peach. Can you taste it? How does that happen? It's amazing. Consciousness can create anything when you start seeing in that more subtle, refined way. It's all a miracle. Don't miss it. Practicing in this way, when you have deep states or a moment of grace, you can see directly, have an understanding of anatta. Did you make that happen? Did you say, I think I'm going to have a moment of grace right now. I think I'm going to have a mind-blowing new way of seeing the world. No, it just happens by itself. You're not running the show, but there's something deep within you that, in my mind, wants to know itself. And then, of course, there is taking refuge in the Buddha, right inside of you, not outside. There is a Buddha, or whatever you call it, the Christ within, the divine within, right inside of you. Take refuge in that. Take refuge in the Dharma, surrendering to something so much bigger. Take refuge in the Sangha, in this beautiful community that you're part of, that you belong. And let yourself connect with what has brought you here to practice. Make it a lived experience, not just a good idea. Remember it. Remember your extraordinarily good karma and see perhaps this natural unfolding as the Dharma unfolding through you. And I think I'll end with a different kind of teaching. I want to play a short Dharma talk for you. 3 minutes and 42 seconds. My favorite Dharma talk of all. Are you ready?
nobody, not mom or dad or grandmother or grandfather or big sister or big brother or teachers or doctors or soldiers or reverends or athletes or lawyers or TV stars or any people who are working or any people who are playing, not even the president, not even a king or a queen. Not even people who love each other know what a single thing is. It is a great and wonderful mystery to all of us that anything is or that we are. And whether somebody says, I don't know how anything came to be, or God made everything, they are simply pointing to the feeling of the mystery of how everything is, but nobody knows what it really is or how it came to be. As long as we go on feeling this mystery, we feel free and full and happy, and we feel and act free and full and happy to others. This is the secret of being happy, from the time you are small until the time you are old. If you will remember every day to feel the mystery, and if you will remember to feel that you are more than what you look like, and if you will remember to be the mystery itself, then you will be happy every day, and all kinds of wonderful happenings will come up for you. You will feel happy, and you will always help and love others, even those who are having trouble feeling happy and are even trying to make you forget the mystery. Someday you may meet someone who has felt the mystery really strong for a long time, so that person feels the mystery all the time and is always happy. Such a person is the best person to learn from about happiness and life and love. I hope you will remember to feel the mystery every day as long as you are awake forever. The best thing to tell anybody is to remember to feel this. I have been doing this for a long time, and it is the best and most important feeling of all. I am very happy I could tell you this. Maybe someday we will meet face to face. Maybe. Anyway, at least you and I will always know that at least one other person somewhere is remembering and feeling and loving the mystery right now.
I hope you remember to feel the mystery, be the mystery, love the mystery, or whatever gives you access to that aliveness. So there's a walking now. We'll come back and again, we'll do a chant, a Nietzsche chant, and again, another little extra treat at the end. So enjoy your walking.